It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. If you are new to the podcast, or if you're enjoying the podcast, please be sure to rate and review us on whatever podcasting platform you use. That really helps spread the show, and it makes me smile when I see a review. So if that's not enough to do it, I don't know it will. Today, we're speaking about capital punishment, also known as the death sentence, a punishment that is still used in parts of the United States and across the world. But when someone is sentenced to die, it's not always what you might think. The average time that an inmate in the States waits on death row is 10 years. While waiting for execution during that time, death row inmates are subjected to conditions that are far, far worse than typical inmates. But is there anything wrong with that? If they've been sentenced to death, do their presumably more severe crimes not warrant harsher treatment while awaiting the death penalty? I'm joined today by Jim Acker, a lawyer and distinguished professor at the University at Albany Criminal School of Justice. He is a leading expert in matters related to capital punishment and death row, and co-editor of the book Living on Death Row, The Psychology of Waiting to Die. All right, so Jim, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me. This really is a topic that is laden with preconceptions. We did an episode a couple years ago regarding the death penalty, and today we're going to focus more on what happens after the death penalty, which is waiting on death row. But I thought it might first be useful to do a bit of a brief recap, so to speak, on where the state stands right now on the death penalty in general, before we get into what happens after somebody is actually convicted and sentenced to death.
Well, sure. Right now, there are 27 states that authorize capital punishment, as well as the federal government and the U.S. military. We're in a period where enthusiasm for the death penalty seems to be declining in the United States. And so in the past couple of decades, 11 states that formerly had and used the death penalty have repealed or invalidated their death penalty laws. So we've gone down from 38 states to 27 states. Simultaneously, public opinion seems to be going against the death penalty more and more. People are supporting alternatives to capital punishment, particularly life without parole. The number of executions has consistently declined since the late 1990s. I think 1998 was the peak period of executions in this country, with 98 people put to death. And more recently, we're in the neighborhood of 20, 22 executions. A hugely significant trend has been the downturn in new death sentences imposed each year. In the mid-1990s, as many as 325 people a year were sentenced to death in this country, and something like 3,700 people were awaiting execution during the 90s and early 2000s. Since then, from that figure, over 300, more recently, it's been approximately 30, 35 people a year sentenced to death. So that's huge. That's a 90% reduction. And currently, just over 2,500 individuals in the United States are awaiting execution under sentence of death. So there's been a lot happening, but that's the big picture of how things stand with respect to capital punishment in the United States right now.
That's an excellent summary of where we're at. And as you illustrate, obviously things are going in the direction compared to 20 years ago of a lot less capital punishment. I remember the last time I spoke with an expert, a lawyer, John Bloom, on this topic regarding the death penalty. There were three kind of main reasons that were cited for why the death penalty is generally considered flawed by those who believe that it's flawed. First of all, that mistakes are made, which is a huge one, that there are wrongful convictions and many people are eventually proven innocent. Even if it's not many, there is a number higher than zero of people who are proven innocent after being sentenced to death. There's also a significant amount of prejudice in sentencing with blatant racial discrimination. And then just the notion that execution is wrong on moral grounds. I know there are many, many reasons why people are not in support of the death penalty, but do you find that those are some of the main reasons that encapsulate what the negative sentiment is about?
Those are certainly among the primary reasons. There are at least two others are frequently cited. You mentioned discrimination based on race, which is a specific kind of a problem. A broader problem is simply the arbitrary administration of capital punishment. It's a crapshoot. There seems to be little distinction between many, many, many death eligible individuals and those who are sentenced to die. And in fact, geography, where one commits a crime within a state, can be more determinative than anything else. So for example, you kill somebody in County A where the prosecutor aggressively uses the death penalty, but you move over a half mile into County B, the exact same crime won't be prosecuted capitally, as well as socioeconomic types of concerns. It's frequently said that those without the capital get the punishment. And there's some truth to that, that people who can afford the best legal representation may generally do fare better. The other principal drawback that many people cite is more utilitarian. It's a damn expensive punishment. Many, many studies have demonstrated that to maintain a death penalty system is exponentially more expensive than maintaining a system where life imprisonment is the maximum punishment. And in the day and age where budgets are strapped, there's concern about health care, housing, education, child care, so many more ways that money might be invested to use it in a system that really is difficult to defend in terms of the good that it does. It's highly unlikely that the death penalty deters murder. It's not needed to protect society. The dominant justification for capital punishment these days is retribution. So yes, to your point, there are many reasons to be concerned about how and why capital punishment is inflicted.
I think one of the biggest preconceptions for me about death row is that when someone's sentenced to die, you kind of assume that's the only sentence that they're going to be serving. But in reality, many of these people end up serving close to a life sentence in prison, in addition to the death sentence. The average length of time an inmate spends on death row is about 10 years in the States, or at least this was from data from the amazing book that you edited, Living on Death Row, The Psychology of Waiting to Die. And many people spend 20 to 30 years awaiting execution. And then approximately 40% of death sentences between 1973 and 2013 were overturned. So the preconception is that when somebody's sentenced to death, okay, you get the death sentence. But in reality, these people are kind of serving two sentences, right?
In a manner of speaking, the peculiarity is that the one and only sentence that they are technically serving is that of death. And while awaiting execution, they are incarcerated. And this period of incarceration is not judicially imposed. It's not a part of the sentence. And the anomaly with respect to the maintenance of death rows, which by and large involve solitary segregated confinement where individuals are in small cells for 22, 23 hours a day without access to programs, exercise, visitation, vocational opportunities, is that the death row environment by and large is a product of administrative decisions by those who oversee corrections. It's not required by the sentence. There are only, I think, three states that by statute require solitary confinement of those sentenced to death. So this extended period, which you've very ably described, I think that most recently the average gap between imposition of sentence and execution was 22 years. That was for people executed in 2019. And as you pointed out, most people who are sentenced to death, strangely, will not be executed. Many, 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 a very hefty proportion of death sentence prisoners will have their death sentences vacated pursuant to the appeals process. So they are being maintained. And once they're vacated, of course, they're shifted to the general population where other prisoners are. So this extended period of confinement under very onerous conditions is something that those who are executed will endure, as you've just said, frequently for 10 years, 15 years, some in excess of 30 years. And you can imagine, I mean, imagine if you can, being confined 22, 23 hours a day in a space that generally is between 36 square feet, this is 4x9, and 108 square feet, this is 12x9 feet, where you're looking at three walls. There might be a slit where food is passed in and out. You're in that cell all but perhaps 1 hour a day, and you're sitting there day after day, week after week, month after year, going on to 15, 20, 30 years. And if that's not a difficult way to spend time, I don't know what is.
Not to mention that while you're in that isolation, you're coping with your own mortality because you're awaiting this very strong possibility that you're going to die as well. And there's a complete amount of hopelessness. I want to read a comment from your book by death row exoneree Damon Thibodeau, because to me this spoke very well to the horrendous conditions on death row, which you've really well described. He says, "I spent my years at Angola while my lawyers fought to prove my innocence in a cell that measured about 8 feet by 10 feet. It had three solid walls, all painted white, a cell door, a sink, a toilet, a desk and seat attached to a wall, and an iron bunk with a thin mattress. These four walls are your life. Being in that environment for 23 hours a day will slowly kill you. Mentally, you have to find some way to live as if you were not there. If you cannot do that, you will die a slow mental death and may actually wish for your physical death so that you do not have to continue that existence. More than anything, solitary confinement is an existence without hope." So solitary confinement is a huge aspect, as you outlined, about being on death row as opposed to your typical inmate who is part of the public prison system. What is the rationale for these bad conditions? Has it been proven to reduce prison violence? Is there any good rationale for why people who are on death row need to be isolated in solitary confinement to that extent? Because 23 hours a day, that is extreme.
The premise is that an individual who's been convicted of a horrific murder and sentenced to death is, number one, very dangerous, and number two, has nothing to lose, and thus is a heightened security risk and escape risk. The generalization about people who have been convicted of capital murder and sentenced to death simply doesn't pan out empirically. When other people are convicted of crimes and sentenced to prison, including aggravated murder, they go through a classification process as an individual, not based exclusively on crime or the sentence. So they're evaluated in part based on the crime, but in part based on their disciplinary record if they've served any other time in prison, a mental health evaluation, and a life history. And then they're classified based on the risk that they present to others in the institution. And they might be given maximum security or a lower degree of security. With most states in the US, this classification is bypassed. And that assumption that I described earlier about heightened dangerousness, heightened security risk is irrebuttable. And now, there have been some states, Missouri is the leading example, where, as I described before, the system of solitary confinement is by and large not mandated by law. It's a policy adopted by prison administrators. And the administrators in the Missouri system decided to try to determine how necessary this heightened security is, which, by the way, is very expensive, and it taxes the staff within prisons as well. So they began to classify, and they mainstreamed. That is, they placed a significant percentage of death sentence prisoners into the general prison population. Let them eat with, recreate with, participate in programs, get jobs, educational opportunities. And these prisoners, the researchers have examined them for several years. They do not separate themselves from other inmates in terms of disciplinary infractions, violent incidents. So if the Missouri experiment were expanded to other states, one might conclude that many prisoners undergoing these onerous conditions of confinement are doing so unnecessarily. Missouri's not the only state that's done this. North Carolina does not allow death sentence prisoners to affiliate with other prisoners, but they do allow them to interact with other prisoners on death row. And that's significant. I think North Carolina has about in the neighborhood of 200 people on death row. And they do work, they do participate in programs, they have joint recreation, communal religious services. So there's more than one way to incarcerate an individual who's been sentenced to death.
Yeah, whereas in Texas, I think prisoners are in solitary confinement in some places up to 23 hours a day. In North Carolina, prisoners on death row are able to spend about 16 hours a day out of their cells, having access to exercise, group dining, completely different experience. What strikes me as odd, and I'm sure you can comment on this as a lawyer, is you're saying it's not legally mandated, a lot of this stuff. It's just policies from the prison. So how does that work from a legal perspective? It sounds strange that such a decision of high magnitude would be left as a policy to the prisons as opposed to being somewhere in the law.
Well, when a legislature doesn't enact a law that's binding on an administrator, the only resort that a prisoner will have is access to the court. And the courts have taken a very deferential stance with respect to how prisons are run. It's only when what's going on within a prison is considered to violate the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishments that judges will intervene. Now, a few jurisdictions have recently settled lawsuit involving allegations that the conditions of death row confinement amount to cruel and unusual punishment. I think very recently, Louisiana and South Carolina have somewhat liberalized the conditions under which prisoners are sentenced to death in order to avoid going to trial and defending their systems against a cruel and unusual punishments challenge. But it's difficult to meet that standard in light of the rationale that administrators will use, which involves heightened security and wanting to avoid a risk to staff and other prisoners. But if you can demonstrate that what occurs is a significant impediment to mental or physical health, the gratuitous, wanton infliction of pain, that's the difficult standard to meet. The courts can and will rule that the conditions have to be ameliorated.
So I want to talk a little bit about the Eighth Amendment there, which is quite critical to this debate. I'm going to play devil's advocate for a bit. Some people listening to this might be thinking there's an argument that once someone's been sentenced to die, society in a way has decided that that person no longer holds rights to the Eighth Amendment, in that if society's decided to kill someone, we've basically said, we're giving you the worst punishment. You're going to die, to be crude, but that's the reality of it. Could it be interpreted that they are no longer under the same protection as other citizens? It's designed, the Eighth Amendment, to protect human dignity. But when you've sentenced somebody to die, some people might be saying, well, you've already stripped them of their dignity.
People have argued that. That argument is inconsistent with the history of the Eighth Amendment, and it's also inconsistent with current understandings. But historically, you know, much of our jurisprudence and constitutional protections relate back to England. And in England in the 18th century and before, when people were sentenced to death, the methods of execution, this is the category that you just described, somebody who's been sentenced to death, we're going to kill them, they deserve to die. What would happen is they would be tied to a horse. They would be tied to a horse and pulled across a long strip of land. So their back is rubbing against the land while the horse is galloping. Then they would be tied to a stake and a knife would quarter their bodies. They would go down the chest vertically and horizontally. Their entrails would be opened up, they'd be removed, and they would be burned. And that was how people were put to death. And this didn't rub a lot of people the right way, right? That there have to be limits on how government is allowed to treat anybody, even somebody sentenced to death. So the framers of our Constitution said, no, the Eighth Amendment is necessary in order to inhibit this impulse to be vindictive, excessively vindictive, even to the most, you know, heinous criminal. There must be a limit on what punishment can be inflicted. You can't inflict cruel and unusual punishment on anybody. And with this history, as we get into the modern era of the Supreme Court and challenges to capital punishment, nobody on the Supreme Court accepts the premise that just because you've been convicted and sentenced to die, you've lost what one judge called the right to have rights. And one of those rights is not to be dealt with cruelly. And again, this definition means the gratuitous, unnecessary, wanton infliction of pain. There must be a restraint on how the government treats anybody, somebody sentenced to die. And this is, as you observed, is consistent with respect for fundamental human dignity, which is said to be one of the values that underpins our Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution.
And I imagine some of the people who argue, well, who cares? These people are the worst of the worst criminals, even though, as you outlined earlier, that's not necessarily the case. A lot of it is arbitrary. But some of those people might argue, well, you know what? they're probably more in favor of capital punishment itself than a lot of the people who don't hold that view. So a lot of these opinions are probably intertwined in that way, that if you support capital punishment, you might care less about their Eighth Amendment rights.
No doubt. The retributive impulse is a strong one. I think it's an understandable one. Murder is a horrible crime. Anybody who's lost a loved one to murder, understandably, will be angry, anguish, and perhaps in a frame of mind to want to respond in kind. But again, that's where the law tries to temper passions, to permit the infliction of punishment, but also to impose limits on it. So you're quite right that the impulse is there. The law is a restraining factor.
Now, going back to something we spoke about earlier, why the wait is so long on death row. And you spoke about history before in Britain. Now, historically in the States, it didn't used to be such a long wait. Executions often took place, not all the time, but maybe within a week during colonial times after the sentencing. So how did this change? And is that a good thing in a sense that the wait is longer because it allows for more thorough appeals processes? Or is this just a bad thing because people are waiting with this uncertainty for so long?
Well, you've asked a mouthful of a question there. Historically, you're right. The period between a conviction and a sentence of death and an execution could be just a matter of days. That was usually back in the 18th century and before. As many people probably do not appreciate the fact that well into the 19th century in this country, in many states and in the federal system, there was not even a right to appeal a criminal conviction. There wasn't any appellate review whatsoever. That gradually changed. Now in all states and under the federal system, there is an automatic right of appeal. Historically, in this country, death sentences were not considered to be atypical or that unusual until the 1960s, when our Supreme Court under Chief Justice Earl Warren began to apply many of the Bill of Rights protections to the states and became a lot more sensitive to the rights of criminal defendants and prisoners. And it was in the 1970s, under our Supreme Court jurisprudence, for the first time where the Supreme Court recognized that, quote, death is different. It's different in kind from any other kind of punishment, including a sentence of life imprisonment. And thus, the concern for reliability in capital sentence must be commensurately heightened. So the appeals process has extended very significantly the time between the imposition of sentence and an eventual execution. I won't try to go through the multiple stages of state appeals, state post-conviction review, federal court review, even executive clemency, but the process is very protracted. I mean, as you point out, it's kind of a conundrum. You can't be both fast and fair. There must be some kind of mechanism to thoroughly review a conviction and a sentence of death in order to make sure that A, we have the right person, and B, the legal procedures have faithfully been followed. As you pointed out, a very high percentage of either capital murder convictions or sentences are vacated at some point during the extended appeals process. Up until 2005, two-thirds of convictions or death sentences were thrown out because of legal error. More recently, it's in the neighborhood of 40%. So sometimes errors are not discovered for a long, long, long time. Focusing on actual innocence. This is how you kind of introduced the fact that that was one of the major reasons people have concerns about the death penalty. There have been something like 185 individuals sentenced to death in the modern era of capital punishment in this country. That's starting in the mid-1970s. So in the past, almost 50 years, 185 innocent people have been sentenced to death. On average, they've spent 14 years on death row before they were released. Some of these purely innocent people, and I'm talking about DNA exonerations now, I mean, there's no doubt we got it wrong, have spent 30 years or more. Now, if the process had gone more quickly, these innocent people wouldn't be around to enjoy the life that they have remaining. Now, I was going to just acknowledge that the extended process is a complaint that many people have. Why on earth do we have to wait 22 years? You know, that was the most between sentence and execution, while the families of murder victims have to remain in limbo with respect to the carrying out of the sentence. By the way, not all murder victim survivors support the death penalty, but the long, long periods are not good for anybody. The people under sentence of death, the families awaiting whatever measure of justice they hope. As I mentioned before, the expense of maintaining people on death row is exorbitant. But to the extent we want to speed it up, we are heightening the risk that we're going to allow innocent people and people who have experienced significant legal errors in their case to be unfairly executed.
Now, of the 40% to two-thirds of people you mentioned before who might not actually be killed after a death sentence,
right,
what percentage approximately of that is because they got it wrong, that they were not guilty at all, they were exonerated? And what percentage of that is they appealed and they said, no, you're still guilty, but we're going to reverse the death sentence and give you life without parole?
Well, I can answer the exoneration question. An exoneration is when the very system that produced the wrongful conviction acknowledges that we got it wrong and you're innocent. And as there are 185 exonerations in this country of formerly death sentenced people since the mid-1970s, there are doubtlessly, in my opinion, other innocent people who remain under sentence of death that we just don't know about because the exoneration process is so difficult. Evidence gets lost, courts are reluctant to grant new trials, etc. Now, when an appeal is taken from a capital conviction, one part of the appeal addresses whether the conviction itself remains valid. And if it does, then we get to the question, were there significant legal errors that make the death sentence invalid? I don't know the precise breakdown between reversals of convictions as opposed to sentences. My sense is that far more death sentences get vacated than convictions. When a death sentence gets vacated, as very frequently happens, the person will be removed from death row and into the general population, and it's the same person now serving a sentence of life without parole or life imprisonment who's now going to be in the general population, no longer on death row.
The general prison population.
In the general prison population, right, right.
Now, what about, Jim, in the event that there is no appeal, which I don't know how frequently that happens, but I imagine there are cases where it does happen, or maybe I'm wrong, but in that situation, how long would the prisoner stay on death row on average in that case? Because if there's no appeals to deal with,
right,
the prisoner is accepting their fate, so to speak. In that situation, there really shouldn't be a long wait at all, right?
That's right. Now, as you might imagine, most people sentenced to death very much want to appeal their conviction and their sentence. In many states, and this might or might not be counterintuitive, an appeal cannot be waived, even by a person who says, I don't want any review whatsoever. The thinking here is that the state, society, has its independent interest in ensuring the integrity of a capital conviction and sentence before it puts somebody to death. That you know, I don't care what the defendant wants. From me, the citizen's perspective, I want to make sure it's right. We have to go through an obligatory appeal. Now, in some state, a defendant can waive, forego all judicial review, as long as it's an informed, voluntary decision. And in the modern era, i.e. the 1970s forward, I know of one, well, the very first person executed in this country in the modern era, a man named Gary Gilmore in the state of Utah, did waive all of his appeals and was executed relatively shortly, a year after his sentence was imposed. In the 1980s, a man in Texas was allowed to waive his appeals, and he was executed approximately 8 months after his sentence was imposed. And to my knowledge, that's the quickest execution in the so-called modern era following a death sentence.
I never would have thought you wouldn't even have the right to be able to waive an appeal. That's fascinating. And obviously there's reasons for that. But, and like you said, the majority of people probably are appealing it, but there are also probably some cases where people say, you know what, I don't want to be living with this cloud over me when I know what the likely outcome is. In fact, there are cases where, I mean, the psychological impacts of being on death row are horrendous, and part of that is because of the sentence that they know is there and they know what's coming, and part of it's because of the conditions they're in. There are cases where people have actually killed themselves in prison in order to expedite the death sentence. So it's tough.
You're right. The guy I mentioned earlier, Gary Gilmore, slashed his wrist in an attempt to beat the executioner to the punch. Gilmore was shot by a firing squad in the state of Utah. There are cases, and this is highly paradoxical, where prisoners have done what Gilmore did, and they will be rushed to a hospital, as Gilmore was. His stomach was pumped. Others He was given a blood transfusion. Well, Gilmore may have overdosed on drugs. Another guy slit his wrist, taken to a hospital, given a blood transfusion so he could be executed. And that's pretty strange, isn't it? We're not going to let you kill yourself because we got to get you better so we can go ahead and do what we promised to do in the first place.
It's such a paradox. And that's really one of the things that struck me in your book, that there's certain parts of your book that address the identification, treatment, and supervision of death row inmates who are at risk of suicide. So there's this emphasis on mental health, but specifically this notion of a suicide risk, presumably because they're a patient of a psychiatrist, and you know, that's a psychiatrist's role, and society's role is to care about mental health. But the irony there is just baffling, that prisons are legally mandated to provide mental health care to inmates to prevent suicide on some level, yet we know what the outcome is. It's so paradoxical.
It's paradoxical, to be sure. I suppose, once again, the rationale is that society has a legitimate interest in inflicting punishment when people commit crimes, and we're not going to let you cheat society's right to impose punishment by your short-circuiting the process.
Is it that they don't want them to short-circuit the process in that case, or is it that they are saying, we still have a right to care for you as a person while you're in prison, so suicide, is the general view, is not a good thing, so we're going to make sure we take care of you until then? Or is it more so you're not getting off so easy? Or maybe a little bit of both?
I don't know. I suppose if anyone were to walk into a situation where somebody had overdosed on pills or slashed his or her wrists and was bleeding profusely, there'd be almost a natural human impulse to want to, quote, help by getting the person back to health. I doubt that people think too long and clearly about the irony of we're going to get you better so we can do what you tried to do to yourself. It's a system that defies logic in a way. The other kind of, and you alluded to this issue with respect to people waiving appeals and more or less deciding that they want to die, involves the issue of so-called volunteers. Now, these are people who have, by and large, undergone their mandatory appeal. They may have even pursued collateral attacks on their conviction or sentence, gone to federal court. They may have been on death row for years and years and have decided, I don't want to be on death row anymore. Now I want to expedite the process. I want to stop any further judicial review. So I'm going to order my lawyers to withdraw all legal challenges to my sentence and go forward with the execution. And this course, it's been estimated that roughly 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 11 of all of the executions that have occurred in this country have been by individuals who have foregone full judicial review. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty here. Is this a rational decision? Because in one respect, it might be rational. You're looking at eventual execution in a high likelihood of it anyway. In the meantime, you're being held, as we described, 23 hours a day in isolation. You've been there for year after year after year. Why not get on with it? Another way of looking at it is that the person has been beaten down psychologically and is no longer making a truly voluntary decision, but is rather making one because of some combination of depression or mental illness. This is sometimes described as the death row phenomenon, where it's a roller coaster. You might have had one or more execution dates set. You think you're going to die, and then something will happen. It'll get postponed. You go back to your cell. It might get scheduled again. You go back. You're on a yo-yo, and you just can't take it anymore. So there are many ways that the mental health of an individual under sentence of death might be compromised, with consequences for, you know, their day-to-day living and whether they're going to keep living.
And there's an excellent chapter in your book written by a psychiatrist who explains, as you're saying, are they even in the appropriate mental state to be making decisions? Because when you're in 23 hours a day in solitary confinement, there is evidence of severe memory loss. You're completely disconnected from reality for some people. Some people go into psychosis. He comments on seeing multiple people smearing feces over the walls in their last several years living. It's tough to, unless you've been in such a situation, which either none of us has, but unless you've lived it, it's impossible to understand the kind of mental toll that takes on you. And you're not yourself. There's no way to be yourself. You're so disconnected from reality. So
precisely, you're right. A high proportion of individuals sentenced to death already suffer from some form of mental illness or other compromising condition. And when confined, as we've been discussing, you don't need to be a licensed psychiatrist to understand how that would exacerbate pre-existing mental illness. But even if you go in without any mental health issues, with that prolonged confinement under those conditions, it has to take a psychological toll.
You mentioned earlier that death row is extremely expensive and issuing a death penalty. Is that because they're in high maximum prisons such as this? And because, what's the main reason that it's so much more expensive than just issuing a life sentence?
Death penalty trials are very, very much more expensive than non-capital trials. Jury selection is prolonged. when done right, because of the so-called death qualification process. You can only serve as a juror in a capital case if you're willing to consider imposing a death sentence. And many people aren't, for moral or religious reasons. They say, no, I can't do it. So defense lawyers try to get those people to not bail out, at least, but jury selection takes a long time, and that adds to expense. Many more expert witnesses are involved. That adds to expense. Many more motions are filed. It's not one trial, it's two. First, you have a guilt phase trial. If there's a conviction, now we have a penalty phase trial, a whole new ball of wax. Now, the reason the dollars add up is that all of this expense is incurred whether or not a death sentence is imposed. And a death sentence is imposed, I mean, it varies tremendously, but in roughly 50% of cases. So in the 50% where it's not imposed, you've thrown out all this money. If a death sentence is imposed, as we've been discussing, 40%, 60% of death sentences at some point will be vacated. So now you've thrown out money because these guys are going to get life imprisonment, and it's been an altogether bad investment. And when you add that to the heightened security and the single selling and the staffing of 22 or more years on death row, that also is very expensive. And that is why a death penalty system is so much more expensive to maintain than a system that said, let's forget about the death penalty. Life in prison is going to be the max. It's been estimated. Now, California is the state currently with the largest death row population. It has more than 700 people awaiting execution in the state of California alone. California's had a death penalty since the late 1970s. Only 13, I think, maybe 14 people have ever been executed. These other 700 plus have just been warehoused on death row all of this time. It's been estimated that in excess of $4 billion, that's billion dollars, has been invested in a capital punishment system in California that's produced 13 or 14 executions in the past 40 years. Now, is that a wise expenditure?
I'm not an economist, but I can say no.
Okay. And that's not many studies in many states have demonstrated that the death penalty is significantly millions and millions of dollars more expensive than a system where we only have life imprisonment. Now, I don't know if I should say only, because life without parole is no cakewalk either.
Jim, you've provided a tremendous amount of insight and knowledge. So I want to thank you. And the last question I want to ask you is, what is the goal moving forward? Because there's a lot of catch-22s here, it seems to me. Is it easier to push back legally as somebody who is at the forefront of this field against the death penalty itself? Or is it wiser to just accept that the death penalty is here and let's try to improve the conditions for people on death row? Let's try to get them more incorporated with the rest of the prisoners as opposed to being in solitary confinement up to 23 hours a day. What route do you take as a lawyer? Because I know you would prefer for the death penalty to just be abolished, but do lawyers and policymakers focus their efforts on getting rid of the death penalty or accepting that that's so hard to overturn? Let's just make sure that the people on death row are in better conditions. And I know that on some level, that's an impossible question to answer.
Yeah, but thankfully, it's not an either or proposition. There's no reason that one shouldn't pursue trying to lessen the onerous conditions on death row while at the same time pursuing repeal of death penalty laws. I think that there are different fronts where one can attack what's going on death row. As we mentioned, there are judicial challenges based on the Eighth Amendment. There have been states recently that have liberalized death row conditions because of those threats. But an education effort that's coupled with, look, you can save money at the same time, because death row conditions aren't usually mandatory, they're a policy implemented by administrators. There's no reason that an education coupled with money savings might not produce more humane conditions of keeping people under confinement while they're awaiting execution. While that fight is being fought, there's no reason not to continue what abolitionists want to accomplish in this country, which is the repeal of death penalty laws. Right now, the courts are not at all sympathetic to fundamental challenges to the death penalty, but with public opinion changing and the errors that we've been discussing becoming more prominent, it's been an amazing. This is how we started. Since 2004, 11 states have thrown out their death penalty laws. Death sentences are way, 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 way down from 325 a year to 30 a year. I think that with violent crime not as much of a front burner political issue in this country, and the multiple reasons that people might raise objections to the death penalty, it's very feasible to keep trying to repeal death penalty laws at the same time trying to make the conditions of death row confinement less daunting.
Well, Jim Acker, thank you so much for taking all this time. You're obviously the foremost expert in this area, and I really appreciate it. Is there anywhere I can direct people to learn more about some of your work or your book?
Well, the book, as you mentioned, is Living on Death Row, The Psychology of Waiting to Die. I just want to give a tip of my hat to my co-editors, Hans Tolk, who is a wonderful fellow who just passed away this summer, a fantastic psychologist, and Vin Bonventri, a law school professor who's a good colleague. So the book is available, Living on Death Row. I'm affiliated with the University at Albany in New York, part of the SUNY system. If one were to go to the University at Albany website, you could track down some of the stuff that I've written. But Zale, let me thank you. These issues are important. You've asked wonderful questions, and the conversation's been very productive, I hope, and very interesting from my perspective. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I hope my questions were not too naive, and I really, really appreciate it. And I think it's an extremely important issue, and that's why I wanted to do this episode. And I think it's going to give a lot of insight to our listeners. So for Jim Acker, I'm Zale Mednick. Thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.